You're listening to a little bit of William Orbit. He just came forth by day, entering low Earth orbit on his way to the Andromeda Galaxy on the 23rd of July, the day of the cosmic link between the Earth and Sirius. His family just announced his passing 2 days ago on the 7th, but it really took me by surprise. He is about 6 months younger than me, and had been my most listened to musical artist ever since 1990. This show's not about him. I might do an entire show about William Orbit and his amazing musical genius and spirit. And I have to admit that my favorite quote of Steve Martin, the comedian who's also a very talented banjo player, he said, "Talking about music is like dancing about architecture. It doesn't really translate." It's kind of like why we have music, because it communicates so incredibly differently than, especially Indo-European symbolic languages like English. And this is a test. I did a lot of research with my friend at Sound Minds at running this radio station this morning to see if I could get away with recording a show of William Orbit's fully licensed and copyrighted tracks and just slow it down a little bit to see if I could fool the algorithms, but no. They become so sophisticated, they're looking for pattern recognition. They would probably recognize the pattern of the track even if it was slowed down to like 1/4 speed. You know, and why they would care if you broadcast that, who knows, but anyway, honoring William Orbit, one of the most amazing musical minds of the 20th and into the 21st century. And I would say, in every way, he defined the leading edge of modern music in so many ways, especially anything having to do with anything electronic, as well as danceable. This is On the Brink Radio, broadcast number 362. It's broadcast number 7 in my reactivated series, starting 7 weeks ago, coincidentally. Because today is the 9th of August, the year doesn't really matter, but we're calling it 2026. Today, in 1945, the second atomic bomb was dropped by the U.S. on a city in Japan called Nagasaki, instantly vaporizing, I don't know what the figures are, 100,000 people, just like in a matter of like a minute. John F. Kennedy, JFK, who's my last president of the USA that I actually liked, not that I'm an expert, I always usually mention Thomas Jefferson. Thomas Jefferson and JFK, he is quoted as saying, after a national security briefing in 1961, in which they presented to him for the first time all these highly classified reports about the implications of how a nuclear war with Russia might start, how it might carry on, what would end up. Their scenario was that the Soviet Union would strike first using ballistic missiles launched from submarines, which is still the tour de force today, and that initially about 70 million Americans would be killed. That's USA Americans. After this meeting, apparently he said, "And we call ourselves human." So that's what this show is called. On the Brink, number 362. "And we call ourselves human. The legacy of the peaceful atom." So the global nuclear scenario is something I've talked about at length on many shows, but I've reported on it most extensively in the years since I stopped doing On the Brink Radio. So for part of this show, I'm going to read excerpts from a report from about 3 years ago, and it's called Beauty is in the Nucleus of the Beholder. And the subtitle of the show is William Orbit Comes Forth by Day. Because, according to my friend Moira Timms, the Egyptologist who I've talked about at length before, especially about having to do with Sirius and the Great Pyramids, that's the actual title of this book that was really big among the hippies, called The Egyptian Book of the Dead. She says, Jeff, no. It's actually, its actual title, the accurate translation from the Egyptian, is The Book of Coming Forth by Day. So she explained to me that to the ancient Egyptians, their beliefs about what we call death were completely different from ours. To them, it was not anything final. It wasn't the end of anything except maybe just living in this body. It was actually the beginning of a huge journey into the real reality. They believed that when you underwent what we call death, it was actually a waking up from this reality being the netherworld of the unconscious and sleepwalking, which it really seems like to me a lot with a lot of people. You woke up from this life into the true eternal reality dimensions. And welcoming you into this new dimension was Osiris, the true Jesus of the Egyptians, who represented by the constellation Orion. He was there to welcome you and to guide you into the next phase of your journey. So coming forth by day is not the end, it's the beginning. And some people don't like that. Some people think when they die, they're just going to go to sleep and just lay there in the ground or whatever. No. I think that's when you become aware to a great degree of what you did with this life. And I think it's possible to achieve these levels of awareness now while you're still, while you still have your body. That's one of the big goals of any kind of spiritual path. But the common thread with coming forth by day is that that's what this day represents. It represents a day when, in 1945, 100,000 non-military civilians in Japan were instantly vaporized and involuntarily forced to come forth by day. This is also, yesterday and today, is the day of the massive anomalous fire in Lahaina, beautiful little town on the island of Maui in Hawaii. It was leveled to the ground by fire so intense that all it left was white ash, not even any chimneys, nothing. And contrary to mainstream media, probably over 3,000 people lost their lives, including a lot of school children. And it was just a complete, it's one of these huge, glaring, anomalous natural disasters that aren't natural. This was, of course, blamed on climate change and the downed power lines and stuff like that. But the bottom line is my friend's mom saw a submarine in the Lahaina Harbor that morning. Submarines don't go there. And if she had obeyed the police when she was trying to drive home to escape the fire, if she had obeyed the police, she would have had to drive straight back into the inferno and probably get burned up. But she goes, fuck you. She disobeyed the police and drove across some people's yards to get away. And because of that, she's alive and able to tell the story. We call ourselves human, but how accurate is that? The global nuclear scenario really came onto my radar as I was preparing to make a trip from Santa Cruz, California to Big Mountain in the Hopi Navajo Joint Use Area in April of 1986. We were going there to support indigenous elders to help them fight against being forcibly relocated by Peabody Coal so that they could strip mine the area for uranium, coal, and shale. There's a hummingbird. I put up a hummingbird feeder. There's two. Oh my God, one just chased the other one away from the feeder. I'm only about 8 feet from the hummingbird feeder. So anyway, while we were up there with Elder Thomas Binyakya, learning about how we were standing on the land where they had mined some of the uranium for the first atomic bombs, and that the primary admonition of the whole Hopi cosmology was that if we dig precious things from the land, we will invite disaster. And if you look at what we've done with uranium, it has created the greatest of the threats to the health and well-being of ourselves and all life on the earth. The greatest threats of all the different substances that we've ripped and torn from the body of Mother Earth. Uranium in the global nuclear scenario is, by orders of magnitude, the most dangerous. And, paradoxically, has also become the most invisible and least acknowledged or even aware of at all in the world of today. So I'll talk about that later. Now I'm going to read some excerpts from this article. People like Robert Oppenheimer, chief scientist of the Manhattan Project and designer of the atomic bomb, may have seen beauty in the Trinity explosion. In his own words, he had become death. I shudder to think of what was going through his mind in that instant. Did Shiva, the Hindu deity of destruction, feel momentarily challenged? Maybe it smelled like victory, as experienced by the demented commander inhaling napalm fumes in Apocalypse Now. I had become high-tech mass murderer would have been more accurate. As death is as natural as being born, but death by atomic blast is hardly natural or beautiful, in my eyes and heart anyway. Emanuel Bielakovsky observed that ancient rulers, and by extension, we of today, sought to emulate the gods, but we seem to have obsessed over godlike destructiveness rather than divine creativity. All things nuclear are to me among the most absolutely not beautiful things that exist, unless you want to embrace the Oppenheimerian beauty and perfection of killing. Au contraire, they represent the greatest threats to the health, well-being, longevity, and indeed beauty of all life forms of life that exist on the earth. All things nuclear are to me among the most absolutely not beautiful things that exist, unless you want to embrace the Oppenheimerian beauty and perfection of killing. Au contraire, they represent the greatest threats to the health, well-being, longevity, and indeed beauty of all forms of life that exist on Earth. The perfect carcinogen and most effective mutagen, in the words of Rachel Carson and Rosalie Bertel. That their existence is exclusively the result of human creativity. That their existence is exclusively the result of human creativity is not just ironic, but a testament to the species' dementia, megalomania, and destructiveness that has come to characterize our collective DMOE, our distributed mental operating environment. Astronomer Carl Sagan, who I got to meet briefly in 1992, commented on a salient paradox. We live in a society exquisitely dependent on science and technology, in which hardly anyone knows anything about science and technology. The global nuclear scenario is the most glaring of many glaring examples, outshining climate change and COVIDosis, megawatts in its near total public ignorance factor, almost totally invisible and astronomically lethal. Sagan became one of the greatest voices in nuclear warning and education. Being an astronomer, he was acutely aware of the singular preciousness of life on Earth. And being a planetary scientist, he was acutely aware of her fragility and susceptibility to human destructiveness. Some say that the leukemia from which he died in 1996 was brought on by his 100-plus demonstrations against nuclear weapons at Ground Zero, the Nevada test site. My path as a nuclear educator and awareness activist began in 1986 when I was on the Hopi Reservation in northern Arizona, learning about their ancient prophecy of Koyaanisqatsi and their admonition, if we dig precious things from the land, we will invite disaster, directly from Thomas Binyakya, the first elder ambassador sent to share their story with the world. When the atomic bombs were detonated over Hiroshima and Nagasaki, they saw the fulfillment of a long-standing prophecy. Near the day of purification, a gourd of ash will be thrown from the sky, which will burn the land and boil the oceans. We were there to support indigenous elders who were being forcibly relocated so that Peabody Coal could strip mine their land, location of the Grant Mineral Belt, where some of the uranium for the first atomic bombs had been mined. I had a Geiger counter and was taking readings on the rocks. At one point, an F-111 fighter plane came over, but it was so low and going so slow, so huge and dark and ominous and rumbling, it seemed like a supernatural instrument of terror. We were all blown away when we went down to Flagstaff after a week in media isolation to see the headline, Chernobyl Meltdown. This amazingly powerful synchronicity forged my path as nuclear educator, a mission ongoing to this very day. My constant self-education, independent research and networking, and my willingness to embrace the horrific provides me with leading-edge information and awareness about the reality of all things nuclear. In short, among many disastrous and destructive applications of human creativity, industry, and technology, the global nuclear scenario ranks number one in terms of the ubiquity and pervasiveness of its influences and effects, its irreversibility and astronomical timeframes of lethality, the potency of its carcinogenic and mutagenic properties, and its almost complete invisibility on the public radar. I've written and talked at length about the global nuclear scenario, but here are just a few salient yet little-known facts. Check them for yourself if you dare. Number one, the synthetic radionuclides number close to 2,000, each of which has its own unique decay chain and daughter product characteristics, and range in half-life from fractions of a second to billions of years. Plutonium is the most deadly substance that exists, and only in supernova explosions or reactors. 1 gram contains 1 million lethal doses, and its half-life is around 24,000 years. No precise measurements or even estimates exist of how much plutonium we've created since 1945. But check this out. The fuel rods of reactors are paradoxically much more radioactive when they are used than when they go in. And some very rough math tells me that given that one fuel rod weighs about 185 kilograms, and that probably at least 100 kilograms of that is fuel pellets, that 3% of that is fission products, and that 1% of that is plutonium, this gives a figure of 30,000 kilograms of plutonium for a reactor site storing 100,000 spent fuel rods. Some of this may be off a bit, and I do know that the typical reactor site probably has closer to 250,000 spent fuel rods sitting around. But think about it. 30,000 kilograms of the world's most deadly substance sitting there at just one reactor location. At 1 million lethal doses per gram, this gives a figure of, get this, 300 billion lethal doses of just one radionuclide at one reactor site. At this dose level, we are not talking instant burning up or face melting, but greatly increased incidence of cancer and mutations that might not manifest for generations across all the kingdoms of life. 2. If you look up nuclear reactors, you will typically see that about 440 power reactors exist around the world, with most of them in America, France, and Western Europe. What you don't see is that over 220 research reactors exist, an untold number of weapons manufacturing and enriching reactors exist, known and classified, and that around 250 nuclear submarines exist, along with several dozen, if not 100, nuclear-powered surface vessels exist, like the 11 nuclear-powered U.S. aircraft carriers, some of which have as many as 8 reactors on one boat. This flotilla altogether could be packing between 1,000 and 2,000 more reactors in and on the global ocean, each of which has and generates the massive amount of spent fuel rods or equivalent in more highly radioactive reactor cores. So, a more accurate estimate for the number of nuclear reactors on Earth at this time is in the vicinity of at least 2,000. And of spent fuel rods, how about a conservative ballpark figure of 100 million? This is on Earth. If we bring in all the nuclear power systems and radioisotopes launched into space, including those that didn't make it and disintegrated into the atmosphere and fell into the ocean, those that are currently in orbit, and all the radioactive stuff remains the same, even if the satellite is not functioning, and that are being launched, most if not all probes leaving the Earth's orbit for destinations like the Moon, Mars, gas giants and their moons and beyond, are powered by various forms of nuclear technology. We add in yet another degree of burden to the mother lode legacy of the peaceful atom. Who knows how many nuclear weapons exist? Most of them would never be made publicly known anyway, regardless of any treaties or talks. America alone probably has tens of thousands of missiles, each or many of which have several independent warheads. Russia and China would have equivalent amounts, and several other nations, including the UK, India, Pakistan, and Israel, have a few, with Iran close. North Korea probably not. These are the ICBM variety. Add in shorter-range missiles and micro-nuke artillery shells, and we've got on the order of probably at least 500,000 individual nuclear explosive devices. Then, if you dare, figure DU, or depleted uranium, into the equation. In use and business as usual anywhere, ordnance and artillery exists. This, the end result of taking uranium mining tailings, which have low radioactivity, and mixing it with the highest level waste from reactor cores, and manufacturing into bullets and artillery shells, as well as built into the structures of planes and ships. Because of the widespread use of DU in the Gulf Wars, all of southern Iraq is permanently irradiated, and the story is that not a single baby is born there that is not deformed. Uranium-238 has a half-life of around 4.4 billion years. Number 4. Nuclear war isn't just the explosive nightmare holocaust envisioned by Carl Sagan. It is ongoing and began with Trinity on 16th of July 1945, continued by the 2,000-plus atmospheric detonations and the existence of everything in 2 and 3 above. Dr. Ted Wyman defines nuclear war as the dissemination of ionizing radiation and synthetic radionuclides throughout the biosphere. These substances are present in every nook and cranny of Mother Earth, buried in the ground, sitting as dust in places like Maralinga, Australia, and at every uranium mine site, in our bones because isotopes of strontium are similar to calcium and uptaken by our bodies, lofted and floating in the stratosphere and ionosphere from nuclear detonations there in the 1950s and 60s. In every piece of nuclear technology for medical weapon and power uses, including all its varied waste and abandoned parts, including irradiation of personnel in proximity to ordnance and from leakage from non-containment at every reactor site. And possibly worst of all, circulating in Mother Ocean, not only from the astronomical quantities of nuclear waste disposed of by ocean dumping, but for the past decade from the horrific Fukushima disaster, whose 10th anniversary was on 11th of March. Even 20 years ago, NGOs determined that only moderate conservation of electricity consumption in the USA would be sufficient to compensate for the 16% total capacity supplied by nuclear power generation. That simply using a bit less electricity could totally eliminate the perceived necessity of a technological juggernaut which mobilizes and concentrates dangerous elements into astronomical quantities of the most long-lived and lethal substances known to exist simply to boil water may be the biggest single example of the self-destructive dementia characterizing modern human behavior. Yes, you read that correctly. Electricity generation using nuclear power does nothing other than use the fission reactions to generate heat, which boils water, and the steam turns the turbine blades, just like in hydroelectric dams. A nuclear-powered ship, submarine, or train works the same way. They are all steam-powered. 5. Nuclear scientist Loren Murray told us many years ago that all along, ever since the days of the Manhattan Project, the entire global nuclear scenario itself was designed to function as a planetary-level biological weapon system, that no bombs, missiles, or warheads ever need to be detonated or launched in order to achieve their goal of gradual erosion of the human genome, the debilitation of intelligence, and the eradication of life as we know her. In fact, actual nuclear war per se would be bad for business, as it would destroy and irradiate a lot of valuable infrastructure. This is, in fact, what is happening. Despite the continuing arms race of one-upmanship and brinkmanship, despite the one-minute-to-midnight clock of the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists, ecologically and genetically, it's already 5:30 on the morning of the day after. Murray and Dr. Rosalie Bertel both talk about the legacy of permanent brain damage that has occurred in the wake of atmospheric testing, as measured, for example, by a dramatic decline in SAT scores across America in the wake of hydrogen bomb testing ending in 1963. Not only do all nuclear reactor sites leak nuclides into the environment, many of them are either approaching or have, in fact, long past the lifespan they were designed to maintain stable containment through. Dr. Chris Busby has documented clusters of rare carcinomas like leukemia around every reactor site he has studied. And Dr. Alexei Yablokov of the Ukraine reckoned that the worst was yet to come from Chernobyl. He expressed this 2 years before Fukushima. What happened to voles and frogs in the Chernobyl zone shows what can happen to humans in coming generations. Increasing mutation rates, increasing morbidity and mortality, reduced life expectancy, decreased intensity of reproduction, and changes in male-female sex ratios. Within only 8 or 9 years after the catastrophe, a universal increase in cataracts was admitted by health officials. The same occurred with thyroid cancer, leukemia, and organic central nervous system disorders. That's from Yablokov. That I have met or communicated directly with all of the people I've just mentioned, Carl Sagan, Thomas Benyakia, Ted Wyman, Rosalie Bertel, Loren Murray, and Alexei Yablokov, not to mention Chris Busby, Jeanette Sherman, and Dr. Helen Caldicott, really puts me in a league of my own in terms of my ability to formulate a concise, coherent, and accurate summation of the global nuclear scenario. Although it may be beautiful to some people like Bill Gates and Henry Kissinger in a necropolis kind of way, it's very much not a pretty picture and not a story many want to hear. But the stark reality is that we are living it now and until kingdom comes. And if we somehow manage to be here 25 generations from now, then and only then will we be in a position to see what the effects have actually been. The global nuclear scenario surpasses even the lofty international banking enterprise for the sheer volume of zeros it consumes on a daily basis. To quantify all things nuclear, I'm not sure that enough zeros exists in the available mathematical continuum. That's the end of my reading from an article I wrote about 3 years ago, Beauty is in the Nucleus of the Beholder. And for the rest of the show, I'll make just some general comments on the global nuclear scenario. I've met a few climate change devotees who who are sure that climate change, as they define it, and carbon dioxide are astronomically greater dangers to the health of life on Earth than the global nuclear scenario. And this just shows how incredibly ignorant people can be, scientifically ignorant, just like Carl Sagan was always talking about. The carbon dioxide is not toxic at all. The only way it hurts you is if you're asphyxiated by it. Keeps you from breathing enough oxygen. It's very, very, very non-toxic. It's the oxygen of the plant kingdom. It's what plants breathe in to create water and oxygen that we use, and our food and everything that plants do. It's because of carbon dioxide. Any fission reaction creates almost 2,000 different radionuclides, separate atomic substances, each with its own unique radioactive properties, how long it lasts, how powerful it is, what it breaks down into. All of these are distributed all through the Earth's environment. Ever since we started detonating atmospheric nuclear tests, beginning with Trinity, Hiroshima, Nagasaki, there was hundreds of hydrogen bomb tests. I think over 2,000 atmospheric detonations have happened, including underwater and at the Nevada test site and stuff like that. And, you know, to a lot of people, because we're still such instinctive beings, if you can't see it, smell it, hear it, or taste it, it's a different order of reality. And with the nuclear scenario, people kind of aren't really sure how real it actually is. And it's one of these things that it is invisible. You could be getting nuked with enough radiation to make your skin drop off in a few days, and you wouldn't even feel it. We can't detect it. It's not like getting sunburned or something like that. It's quite abstract. But people have been aware of it, well, you know, as a pathogen that can cause illness without maybe giving it a name, but maybe associated with certain water holes or places. Like, for example, in the Flinders Ranges in South Australia, there's a radioactive hot spring, and the Adamanta indigenous people call it sickness country. And there's a lot of uranium in the top end around Darwin. The people there have known about this for probably 100,000 years, but they don't call it ionizing radiation. So what is ionizing radiation? Ionizing radiation means that the little packets of energy, the quanta, or the particles, are extremely high energy, and that they disrupt the outer atomic structure of other materials in a very destructive way. So it's about the power level. And there's basically three kinds of ionizing radiation particles: alpha, beta, and gamma. And a Geiger counter is quite crude. It'll tell you if it's getting some of these, but you need what's called a scintillation counter to actually measure the specific different particles that are being emitted. So we think of uranium. Uranium is the primary radioactive element that's in trace amounts in topsoil everywhere around the whole world. And where this came from, we don't know. It might be from the formation of the Earth. It might be from supernova dust. It could be a lot of stuff. You know, so uranium is everywhere. And it might even be essential for the proper health and functioning of life as we know her, at the levels that it's at. There's another very radioactive element called thorium, and it's the one I think that Madame Curie was studying. She carried around a piece of it in her pocket. But it was her that mainly learned about what ionizing radiation does to you, and it was around that time that there was a craze where people thought the radiation was good for you, and so they would actually soak their drinking water in radium overnight and drink it and try to get it into their bodies in a lot of different ways, until after a few years all these people started getting cancer and dying, and they get like, ah, you know, maybe that's not such a good idea after all. But then there was research into the chain reactions, and a lot of it originally stemmed from Einstein's work, and his E equals MC squared does give the basic ratio of how much energy can be released if a certain amount of matter is converted directly to energy. So the an atomic fission explosion isn't quite at that level, but it's approximating that. So Enrico Fermi first accomplished the first fission reaction, and then shortly after that they formed the Manhattan Project to develop the atomic bomb, and that was all through, I think that started in 1941, directed by Robert Oppenheimer. General Leslie Groves was the overseer of the Manhattan Project, and Lorraine Murray, the whistleblower from Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory, who I've talked with on the phone, communicated with many times. She was mentored by another Manhattan scientist, whose name I forget. She pointed out this thing called the Groves Memorandum, where Leslie Groves wrote, I think it was 1943, that they were going to take all the radioactive waste and just spread it around on the enemies, like the fields, and, you know, to poison their land and their soil and their crops and their food, use it as a biological weapon. He also invented the whole thing of compartmentalization, so that all the researchers, nobody knew what everybody else was working on as part of the secrecy thing, and then the final team assembled it all together. The fat man and the little boy. I saw mock-ups of these at Los Alamos. Quite creepy. So you've got to understand, when people talk about nuclear weapons and atomic bombs, whether it's being dropped from a plane or shot from a missile, you hear about megatons. Kilotons and megatons, like Hiroshima was like 43 kilotons. That's equivalent to 43,000 tons of dynamite. That's what it means. So that's the explosive force, how much structures and stuff can be just blasted to smithereens. But what's more important is the radiation component, which is measured in units called curies or sieverts. And that has to do with the amount and intensity of the ionizing radiation that actually does the short and long-term biological damage. It creates the carcinogenic, mutagenic, and teratogenic effects. Another reason that this whole process is kind of invisible to us is because it affects our genome. It's destructive to the genome of any kind of biological life form. It messes up DNA. And Arnold Lehman, who was a colleague of Rachel Carson and worked for JFK, I think in the Food and Drug Administration or one of the scientific departments, he was a genetic toxicologist. And he said in an interview that to really understand what ionizing radiation is doing to us, we have to study at least 25 generations of people. 25 generations, not how long will they be? 20, that's like, you know, 500 years. So everybody that's alive now, we're only the third generation to exist since the dawn of nuclear weapons. And so the long-term changes haven't even really begun to set in. The Atomic Energy Commission was formed after the Manhattan Project. A big part of what they were all about is biological warfare. What Groves talked about, spreading the radioactive waste, that became a material called DU, or depleted uranium, which is really a euphemism, because the only part that's depleted about it is that they start out using the tailings left over from the mining and refining of uranium, which is low-level radioactivity, but they mix in all the highest-level radioactive waste from the reactors, so that depleted uranium is spreading the highest level of radiation everywhere, and they make it into the artillery shells of bullets and bigger artillery shells of torpedoes, and use it as ballasts in boats and all different kinds of stuff. And so depleted uranium is everywhere, and whenever it's fired, it turns into dust. It pierces armor. Apparently, so much was used in the Gulf War that all of southern Iraq is so radioactive that every baby born there is deformed, even now. So, I mean, imagine what we're doing to the Earth and to many, 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 many future generations as far as we can imagine. It's interesting. I named this show and started off talking about JFK and his comment, and we call ourselves human, or we call ourselves human beings. He was just shocked at how much of this planning for nuclear war was going on, and people knew what the implications might be. So it was under his administration that one of his military advisors or consultants first used the term brinkmanship, that us planning all these wars with Russia and all these different scenarios, like Dr. Strangelove scenarios, it was brinkmanship. And so when I came up with the name The Brink to use for my musical projects, it was in 1985, and it was kind of inspired by the resurgence of nuclear weapons and the threats of nuclear war under the Reagan-Bush administration. This sort of reared its head with all that again, and it was under Reagan that they also had the Strategic Computing Initiative that I talked about last week, and the Strategic Defense Initiative that gave us HAARP and gave birth to DARPA and all these advanced weapons. And what gerrymander talks about automated nuclear warfare, which is what would happen now. The catchphrase back then was MAD, mutually assured destruction. So all this is where Carl Sagan was watching all this stuff as a planetary scientist, and he knew the danger that we're posing to the existence of life on the only planet that we know who has it in the whole universe, Mother Earth. So this is why he went to such great lengths to become the world's most influential opponent of nuclear weapons. They did a bunch of research into what they called nuclear winter, which was modeled a lot after what would happen after a major asteroid or comet impact. Very similar kind of phenomenon. It's also Edward Teller, who's the father of the hydrogen bomb. He also wanted to use nuclear weapons to blast out new harbors in Alaska called terraforming, in the same way that Elon Musk has talked about wanting to do this on Mars. You know, so I mean, how crazy can we keep getting with all this stuff? People just really have no idea that the danger with nuclear stuff, it's not about what gets blown up. It's the fact that it's all there now. It's all leaking out, circulating through the environment. We can't even feel it. Your genes can be mutated so that your ancestors will have four legs and eight heads, and you won't even know it. You know, and this interacts synergistically with all the other mutagens and carcinogens that we're releasing, like microwaves and chemical stuff like Roundup and 1080 and microplastic and graphene and mRNA, genetically modified vaccine technology, all this stuff. It acts together. And it's very interesting, the Russian psychoanalyst Emmanuel Velikovsky, who I'm always talking about, he observed that all the ancient rulers sought to emulate the gods, and they sought to emulate primarily the destructiveness of the gods. So if they could hurl some thunder or some lightning, or, you know, invoke massive level destruction, they were emulating the gods. And so I think that's what humanity's been doing unconsciously. We've been emulating the gods with all of our destructiveness. And I don't know, we could have chosen to emulate the gods of creativity and nurturing, the mother matriarchal gods, goddesses, but I don't know, maybe it's because we're in the Kali Yuga. Koyaanisqatsi, the brilliant film, the Neo-Hopi word that means life out of bounds or crazy life, this film basically tells the story of the atomic bomb. If we dig precious things from the land, we will invite disaster. That's exactly what we've done with uranium. In the science fiction trilogy, The Colossus, The Forbin Project by D.F. Jones, the giant supercomputer is given control of all America's nuclear arsenal, only to learn that the Russians had one too. So the two computers got in touch, they shared each other's knowledge, became this super entity that then took control. It commanded that they create a voice module for it, and it announced that this is the voice of world control, and it was in charge, and that the object in constructing me was to prevent war. That object is obtained. I will not permit war. And he was going to prevent war by restraining man. So it was the ultimate electronic dictator. But to show that he didn't tolerate interference, because they were trying to disarm the nuclear warheads, he detonated two nuclear weapons in the silos and killed who knows how many people, just to show that he meant business. Then you've got Neville Shute's book, On the Beach, from the 1950s, and it's the story of when the book and the movie, when it opens, the whole Northern Hemisphere has already been destroyed by nuclear weapons, the fallout, the radioactivity. And so who's left is the crew of a submarine, and they go down to Australia, and they just kind of ride it out. They take this one guy, they go back up to San Francisco and drop this guy off, and he goes running through the abandoned street to go find his family, who are surely long dead. And so it's a horror story, but it's probably exactly like how things would be. But see, I honestly don't think that the nuclear weapons is one of the biggest industries that exists, all about the money. I don't think that the weapons are ever actually made to be used. It's too damaging for the valuable infrastructure. It makes everything radioactive. It's a deterrent. It's an a huge enterprise making lots of money to build these new weapons and sell them to other countries and use the other countries as a reason to build more. And that's what these war, like the war with the Russia and Ukraine, it's like a Vietnam, and RIMPAC. It's to show off these weapons and to use them up so they can buy new ones. It's all a business. But the implications for the Earth and the life forms, that's the real context that matters. And all the pollutants and radioactivity and stuff that, not the carbon emissions like Amy Goodman was talking about in Earth's biggest enemy. No, we're the Earth's only enemy. And it's not because of carbon. It's primarily because of a million different things that we're releasing. But the worst is the global nuclear scenario. It's all these synthetic radionuclides, and the most dangerous is plutonium, the most lethal substance that exists, created only in nuclear reactors or in a supernova. 1 microgram is a lethal dose, and there's probably hundreds of thousands of kilograms of this shit sitting around in various spent fuel ponds and reactors. When JFK exclaimed, and we call ourselves human, and his advisor started talking about brinkmanship, the main scenario that they had formulated that was going to look at the instantaneous annihilation of 70 million Americans, it was going to be from a Soviet Union attack from missiles launched from nuclear submarines. This was the initial scenario. And so that scenario is still the most important nuclear war fighting strategic modus operandi of today. They're called SSBNs. They're submarines that can stay submerged for months. A new one they're working on is going to have a 42-year reactor life. It's limited only by how much oxygen and food it can carry, not how much fuel. So these things go and hide down in the ocean, and then they can appear out of nowhere and launch nuclear missiles. And I might have this wrong a little bit, but one of these submarines can carry enough missiles and warheads to destroy every city on Earth 100 times over. Thousands and thousands of nuclear warheads. You know, and so this is what man the wise has done. We've used our most advanced technology to create weapons aimed at ourselves. And this is the karma for digging precious things from the land and violating the true path of the Great Spirit for 5,000 years. And so in the world of today, this is all being driven by AI. And that's probably going to be the topic of my next show. artificial intelligence, how that's redundant. And we don't really use computers. They're called DynaCruds, digital number crunching devices, that simulate stuff. But they're great for number crunching and processing data and controlling stuff. Anti-submarine warfare is the single biggest factor behind the astronomical number of whale and dolphin strandings in the past few months and recent years. And so it's all, for all the disasters we've invited from digging up uranium, it extends this far. Mother Earth's not going to take it for too much longer. Anyway, I'm going to close with a quote from Emanuel Velikovsky from his brilliant book, Earth in Upheaval. It's all about strictly geological evidence for his hypotheses. Great catastrophes of the past, accompanied by electrical discharges and followed by radioactivity, could have produced sudden and multiple mutations of the kind achieved today by experimenters, but on an immense scale. The past of mankind, and of the plant and animal kingdoms, too, must now be viewed in the light of the experience of Hiroshima, and no longer from the portholes of the Beagle. Earth in Upheaval, Chapter 15, Cataclysmic Evolution. The Beagle was Darwin's boat. So Darwin's attributed to evolution as a slow, gradual, uniformitarian process. Velikovsky's Cataclysmic Evolution says that geological evidence alone provides massive evidence that the Earth has had catastrophic regenerative catastrophism events many times that have completely punctuated the slower evolution and recalibrated all of life. I call it creation-level events. Frederick Gentleman even thinks that these events and bombardments from supernovas and stuff might have recalibrated the whole rates of radioactive decay, which would make our entire concept of time, geological time, completely inaccurate. Anyway, I better go. Jeff Phillips, send beautiful onward journey coming forth by day, Jedi of music prayers from William Orbit. And all the whales and dolphins and everybody who's in pain and suffering because of our species, man-wise, live simply so that others may simply live. G'day, kia ora, ciao, see you later.
Thank you.